Today is April 19th, 2024, and we welcome you to our Chapter 49 podcast. My name is Larry Lannon. I'm a retiree and a volunteer for Chapter 49. As most of you probably know, Chapter 49 represents most IRS employees in the state of Indiana. We're happy you have chosen to spend a little of your precious time with us today, either watching or listening to our podcast. And we welcome once again our chapter president, Duncan Giles. Welcome back, Duncan.
Thanks, Larry. It's always good to be here with you.
Well, I want to start off with this. You know, you and I both love sports, so we follow sports a lot. And one of the biggest sports stories in recent weeks is the ascendancy of the women's basketball tournament, the NCAA basketball tournament, which is largely attributed to one player, Caitlin Clark, from the University of Iowa. She has now graduated from the University of Iowa, and she entered the WNBA draft, and as expected, because the team had the number one draft pick, the Indiana Fever, based in Indianapolis, chose Caitlin Clark as their number one draft choice. Not only have ticket prices for Fever games at Indianapolis tripled since that happened, and I don't even know what the secondary market's doing, every single team that's going to play, they're going to play on the road, has a very special event all set up. The first time the Fever play this coming season. And, you know, it's such a feel-good story, you know, seeing women's sports get all the attention that it probably has deserved. The quality of play in the women's basketball at the college level is so good these days. It's good that people are watching it and starting to pay attention to it. So here's Caitlin Clark. She is, you know, flown to Indianapolis to have her first news conference with the local media. And all of a sudden, all these reporters get a chance to ask her a question. Question comes up from Greg Doyle. Greg Doyle is the sports columnist for the local newspaper, the Indianapolis Star. So during that press conference, Greg Doyle started his interaction with her by saying, quote, "Real quick, let me do this." And he did a heart sign with his hand, something that Clark does at the end of every game during her college career. And so Clark looked at him and said, "Oh, you like that?" Doyle says, "Well, yeah, I like that you're here. I like that you're here." Clark, "Well, yeah, I do that at my family after every game." And then Doyle responded, "Hey, start doing it to me and we'll get along just fine." Oh, dear. Oh. The word clueless comes to mind. He had no idea what he was saying or the impact of it. And it got worldwide attention. I have seen everybody in and out of sports commenting on this. And then Doyle knew what he had done, obviously, pretty quickly when that all happened. That blowback came, sends a Twitter or X message, whatever you want to call it these days. And he sent this message out saying, quote, "I sincerely apologize," unquote. What I find interesting is a lot of the female journalists and sports who know him have gone on X and Twitter and said, "We don't buy his apology." So I really feel that's not a good sign for Mr. Doyle. So I don't know about you, Duncan, but I think years ago they used to call the sports section of a newspaper the candy store. You know, it's not the real journalists, it's the people who play like they're journalists and cover sports, and they don't get into real reporting very much. That did change over the years. There was some real good journalism done in the area of sports as the years went along. I mean, that's what somebody said, I think, back in the 1960s when I was a kid. But I still think there's some of that frat boy attitude in the sports departments, and it's with the ascendancy of women's sports, which is a good thing, I think that's going to have to change.
Yeah, it absolutely has to. And you know, I'm on a text chain with Greg Doyle as a subscriber to our Star, because I try and keep local journalism alive where I can, and I express my severe disappointment with how he acted. It was just so uncalled for. I mean, you know, this is one of the reasons that the WNBA last year barred men from reporters from the locker room because of this type of attitude. And it's just in this day and age, you know, women are equal, period, end of story. You know, actually, you know, in cases like my wife and daughter and your wife and daughter and people we work with and know, they're above men. So it shouldn't be, you know, this type of thing should not be done or tolerated. It really saddens me in this day and age to see this kind of thing still go on. You know, I think that he probably didn't intend for it to come their way. It's bad enough when you're digging the hole by doing the heart thing, but then saying, well, if you do it to me too after the game, you know, this is a guy who's got a girlfriend, you know, professes to be in a long-term relationship, and he made what he thought was a lighthearted remark. But that just is the ugly, misogynistic side of journalism that we need to get away from totally.
Yeah, you talk about barring men from the locker rooms of the women's sports. Do you remember? It was a lot of years ago when women journalists started going into NFL locker rooms. And, oh, that didn't go well. It wasn't just the fellow journalists. It was the players who were the problem. Finally, what happened is so the star players and coaches started coming out into a press room so they could talk to them and not actually. And going into the locker room was never something that was necessary. It was just a tradition from the old boys' school of being in sports. So this really, Duncan, kind of dovetails what you and I did every day. I did every day. You continue to do every day. Is that try to get into people's heads that women need to be respected. End of discussion.
Yeah, it's a pretty simple concept. And going back to what you just said, I wish I'd have kept the letter. I did receive a letter from a former NBA commissioner when I was working for the Pacers. Actually, it was handed down to me because for a couple of years and the end of my high school years, I was the visiting room locker room attendant for the Pacers. And I would not allow women in that locker room, not because I didn't think they couldn't do the job or be impartial or all that, but because of the misogynistic attitude. And I told players, you know, if these women reporters want to interview you, I'm dragging your butt out there, mm-hmm. and you're going to talk to them. Mm-hmm. You know, or you may find some, you know, red hot balm in a certain piece of equipment that you don't want it in. But I mean, it's just, it's sad when you see these types of attitudes. We've come so far, and there are so many great professional writers and athletes out there now that don't even think about stuff like that. When you see an example of the misogynistic attitude, it just sets everybody back, and it's just sad.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's I think Caitlin Clark coming to Indiana is a very big thing, and she – and I think it's a big story and should be a big story. She has done so much for women's sports and college basketball. And now the WNBA, I think, will continue to grow. We'll see. We'll see. But these are societal problems that are being seen in the sports world. And, sometimes that says a lot about us, puts a mirror to us when we see things happen in sports. But let's get serious, very serious now, because we are recording this and posting this podcast on April 19th, and 29 years ago, Duncan, you and I were working in the IRS toll-free center, and I do remember, you know, we're tied to our desks when we're taking a phone call. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's just, you know, you can't get them walk around while you're working. And while I was at my desk working in the morning, that late morning of April 19th of 1995, I saw a lot of activity going on, people rolling television sets into offices and watching. I wasn't sure what was going on. Finally, I got a break, and my manager told me that the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City had been bombed and that half the building was gone based on the pictures and video that they were seeing. This is a very important anniversary we all need to recognize, not celebrate, of course, but recognize and remember. I think there's a sense maybe when we get further and further away from an act like that, and we've had so many other terrorist attacks since then, But this remains, Duncan, the most savage terrorist attack in America done by an American.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'm with you. I was, you know, it was my first year working for the service 29 years ago. And I was doing a quick assignment for helping out a manager, and they had the TV on, and just seeing that, it just totally blew me away that somebody would do this type of thing. You know, our security is amped up in all federal buildings now, because, and to sometimes to an nth degree more than it needs to be, but we want to make sure that we never, ever have a situation like this again where homegrown terrorists, you know, it wasn't just federal employees they killed. It was innocent men, women, and children in the daycare there. So it's a very somber occasion that really makes me think every year when this comes around about, you know, how precious life is, what could possibly happen, and that we want to safeguard our employees to the best of our ability.
There was a TV crew that showed up that later that day wanting to get reactions from federal employees, and for some reason they tapped me to talk to this reporter. And all I could think about were my one-year-old twin daughters who were in a daycare, not in a federal building, but were in a daycare that day, and thinking, knowing that there were children in that daycare, and that we later found out Timothy McVeigh purposefully positioned that fertilizer bomb close to the daycare. So it was a sad day for America and all of us. But as federal employees, anybody who worked for the government that day, I think we lost our innocence. We all knew at that time that if you had a federal building in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles, you know, major city, that was a target. For somebody to target and attack the federal building in Oklahoma City, that's where we in Indianapolis realized, ooh, this could happen to us.
And apparently Indianapolis was one of the places they discussed before they decided on Oklahoma City. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. You just never know, and it could happen anywhere. And losing our innocence is probably the perfect phrase. Now we're always ever vigilant because of things like this and 9/11. And we have to be. It's an unfortunate part of the way the world is, but we have to be vigilant and make sure that we're aware of our surroundings and what's going on to protect ourselves and our fellow employees.
I want to do a little plug. I don't do this often, but I just think it was so well done. If you have HBO or what's now been rebranded as Max as a streaming service, they have a new documentary that they've just released, and it's very well done. The executive producer is Katie Couric, the former Today Show host. And they bring in a lot of people who covered that. Mike Boettcher was an NBC News reporter who's now retired. But NBC sent him to Oklahoma City because they knew he grew up in a town in Oklahoma. And he knew Oklahoma City very well, knew the area. And he had covered international news. He had covered Beirut bombings, for example. Pretty ugly bombings in that city, which had a civil war going on at the time. And he goes to Oklahoma City, looks at that federal building, and says, it reminded me of what I saw in the Middle East and in Beirut when I was covering bombings there. He said it was just awful. But what happened is they, Couric and Boettcher and other journalists stayed in touch with the families of the victims, so they got to know them as covering the event, and they tap into these people who were more than willing to talk about it 29 years later. And they go into a lot of detail as to how people became radicalized, hating the federal government. It goes all the way back to 1979. I won't give too much away, but that's when this all got started. Farm policy, of all things, ended up starting this hatred of the federal government. But it's worth seeing. It tells the story in a different way than other documentaries have told the story. But let's never forget this, Duncan. I think we all, as a society, need to remember this. Yes, we've had worse attacks since. It's still the worst domestic terrorism incident we've had in the United States. So it's worth remembering, and that's why we bring it up as our first serious issue today. want to move on to something else. We've talked about this before. As we've said several weeks ago, the National Executive Vice President of NTU has resigned, and as a result, there is a special election that was held. It was held by mail. The ballots have been counted. So, Duncan, tell us the result of that election and where we go from here.
Yeah, the there were five candidates running for National Executive Vice President to be second in command to Doreen Greenwald, who's been on our program and is a longtime friend of mine. And as I predicted early on that there would not be anybody that got a majority of the votes, over 50%, and the top vote getter did not get over 50%. So there will have to be a runoff of the top two vote getters. There have been some challenges to this election. You know, people hear, oh, there's a challenge to the election. There must have been something wrong. Not necessarily. There are often challenges to elections in this type of situation. The vast majority of them do not prove enough to redo an election. There is not enough there to redo an election. So they let the results stand as is. There'll be an outside counsel looking at this because we, as a union, want to do things right, and Doreen is, to me, is doing the absolute right steps in this. So right now we're kind of in a holding pattern. We need to get the investigations done, make sure that, you know, whatever challenges there were, see if there's any validity to them. If there is validity to them, did they influence the outcome of the elections? And if not, then we will have a second election where the top two vote getters will be running and will be voting. We don't know yet what the date of those will be.
So the first things first, and these challenges do have to be ruled upon, and there'll be some outside counsel working on it. It will not be just Doreen Greenwald, though she'll make the final decision. She will take counsel from outside attorneys who will look at this independently. To look at the validity of those challenges, and she will either accept the challenge and do a new election, or she will turn the challenges down and move on to this run. Runoff elections are held in several states, by the way, in the United States, where if nobody gets 50% of the vote, the top two will go at another round of elections. It's not an unheard of style of election. It's used in many states to elect governors and senators and that kind of thing. So that's the next step. We'll keep you posted right here as to, because there is some interest in who the new executive vice president will be. That is the number two person in the pyramid that goes up, you know, the steps of IRS, not IRS, but NTU, representing all the different agencies, including IRS. But the national executive vice president is a very key position. So we'll keep you posted on them, what's going on there on this podcast and at our Facebook page as well. Want to get into something else. When we had Doreen Greenwald, and I think I also other national union officials have been on this podcast, I've tried to reference the recent statements that have come out of the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and also out of the Treasury Department on limiting telework. Telework, going back to the days of FlexiPlace when it first came in the mid-1990s, had one rule that's been constant. You know, if you're on working at home, FlexiPlace or telework, whatever it might have been at the time, you were required to be in the office 2 days out of a pay period, 2 days out of 10 work days, essentially. You're required to be in the office. And that's been a long-standing provision of our contracts. We're going through the final phases of midterm bargaining, and all of a sudden the management has completely changed proposals. The management has come up with something much different than that, how should I put it, than that system of 2 days every 10 workdays being in the office within that pay period. So, Duncan, some very interesting developments have occurred in that whole national negotiation. You've been involved in national bargaining. Tell us what's happening and what it may mean.
Yeah, this is for the, right now, the chief counsel, the folks who are our attorneys that are under the chief counsel's bailiwick, are negotiating their contract, and it came out that everything was going to be matching up very much like the IRS and Telework. And then they came back with a proposal that was very regressive that basically said 50%. And, you know, the national NTU folks at the table were going, well, the chapter leaders and the national NTU folks were going, okay, what data are you basing this on? Well, come to find out, they're not basing it on any particular data. It's the saying, okay, well, they're trying to tell us to come back to the office, so we need to. And, you know, I don't want this to be a foreshadow of what the IRS might do in a few years when the 2022 national agreement for the rest of the IRS bargaining unit employees expires. You know, I understand that, you know, that there are a lot of executives and management officials who want to see people in the office. They believe in the synergy. They believe that, you know, if you have people there, it'll run better. Everything will be better. People are not as productive if they're at home. And unfortunately, none of those have proven true for management. Actually, people are more productive when they're home than they are in the office. Things like leave, sick leave, AWOL, Family Medical Leave Act, all of that leave is reduced when you have people that are able to work from home more extensively. Then you have the issue of rent reduction. If you're able to get to desk sharing, you're able to save some money with that. Well, what the council negotiations have done, the chief counsel said, well, basically, yeah, we want more people come to the office, but we want to increase the number of desk sharing, which just, you know, makes my head just explode, because I know they're lawyers. I know they're good folks, good men and women that are negotiating this nationally, but apparently they failed basic math. If you have people in the office that are sitting in the office, you can't have like a 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 desk sharing because they'd be sitting on each other's lap. You know, I'm sorry, it's basic math. It's pretty simple algebra, but they apparently failed to grasp that. And that is, you know, extremely disappointing. And that's what happens when you're not going by facts, when you're not going by what the data says. You're going by what you feel should be happening based on what everybody is saying. Well, back it up with the data, back it up with the facts. Let's go from there. But unfortunately, they are not right now in the council negotiations. Hopefully, like I said, this will not be a precursor to what's going to happen when the national agreement expires in a few years. Management has not and cannot do anything to the rest of the bargaining unit employees for telework. That, unless Congress makes a legal change, we still have our telework the way it's set up. So the telework you have now is the telework you're entitled to and will be entitled to for the next few years, but we don't want to see a regression from that.
Yeah, and I think a little history might be in order here, Duncan, because it's only been in, like, what, the last 10, 15 years that the attorneys and chief counsel were part of the NTEU bargaining unit. And we've only represented them for a shorter number of years than the rest of the IRS. But yet the contract was fairly similar to what we have seen with the rest of the IRS. There were certain parts of it that had to be special for people doing that work. They do their work a little bit differently, obviously, in their role as chief counsel attorneys and support people who work in that operation. But I think it is a foreshadowing of what may happen in our next national bargaining. If I implied that it was going to apply to all of the IRS, it's not what I intended to imply. So it is just the chief counsel attorneys that would be involved here. But you're right, Duncan. Here's the other thing. When NTEU asked what data this was based upon, they couldn't provide any, which kind of indicates why they come up with this desk-sharing arrangement that makes no mathematical sense. But you've seen this before outside of council, have you not?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of our favorite things to do is when we get some of these proposals, be it nationally or locally, you know, to say, okay, show me the data behind this. Show me what you're trying to do. Show me how this is going to make it better. Well, we just think it should be this. That's fabulous. It doesn't matter, but that's fabulous. No, you're going to need to have data, because if we're going to go before an independent fact finder or, you know, go before the impasse panel, you guys are going to need facts, not just your opinions. And too often they don't have those facts, because they're not that. They just have the opinions. And right now there's a bunch of groundswell politically to have people return to work. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, they're not doing this or that. I haven't gotten my refund because people have, you know, are still working from home and aren't doing anything. And I had that discussion just a couple of weeks ago with somebody, and I turned to them and I educated them. Let's put it this way. I educated them on how untrue that statement was, and that they should broaden their horizons when they're trying to get information. But I mean, that's a stereotype out there. And you can't bargain with stereotypes. You need to do it with data and what's best for the organization. Because if you start taking away telework, you're going to be, you know, not only is your recruiting going to be hurting, but your retention is going to stink. Because if people have to start coming into the office more often, I can guarantee you that people who are retirement eligible will sit there and say, you know what, it's not worth it to me to come in. I'm not even going to hassle with it. I'm just going to retire. Because we've seen this with other agencies. There's your data. That's what happens.
Well, yeah, we'll keep you posted on this. I just get angry when I see certain elected officials say people who are working telework in federal government are sitting on their couch playing on the internet or watching TV. No, no, no. That's not true. They're working just like they would be working in the office. That's what the data shows, as Duncan says. I want to ask about one thing, Duncan. We at NTU represent IRS, but we also represent employees at the National Park Service. They're a fairly recent entrant into our bargaining unit. It was a very interesting arbitration that came down recently. Talk about that.
Yeah, basically what the Park Service had done and is said, okay, we need more people at our Grand Canyon area. And so we're going to transfer these people. We want to transfer you to the Grand Canyon area. Okay, you've got to pack up, move your family across the country or, you know, however many miles you had to go. So these employees did it. Then there were some things that were happening that weren't as promised to them. So they filed, you know, talked to the union, filed grievances, and, you know, the Park Service canceled their details after they had already spent the money to move out there and do this for the good of the Park Service. They canceled the detail on them in a strictly retaliatory move. And so this went to, you know, an arbitrator, and they basically found that, yeah, this was retaliatory. And IRS, you know, filed briefs about this. And this is good for us, for any agency we represent, including the IRS. It strengthens the notion that people, employees, should be free to come and talk to the union about issues. And if you take that as something that's bad and something that you don't like and retaliate against them, this is going to end up costing you, as it costs the Park Service, about $300,000 to repay these employees. So, you know, that's the key message that came out of this is, you know, there are going to be penalties for retaliation if you strike back against employees for going and doing their contractual legal rights to talk to the union about issues, if need be, to have, you know, issues filed formally. Even informal discussions, we've seen where people try and management tries to retaliate. I've seen it myself, and I've cautioned them about the dangers of this and told them what would happen. And the vast majority of the time, they're like, oh, this is not good. Yeah, I better not do this. And I'm like, exactly. And I know a lot of chapters across the country have to deal with these types of issues, and we're very up on this. So having another case where it's, you know, clear cut that there's penalties for, you know, the courts say that there are penalties for retaliation against federal employees who are covered by unions is a good thing to have. I hate that it happened to these people from the Park Service, and I hope that what they got made them whole. But it's a good legal case for us to be able to stop bad management or bad leaders or bad executives from doing things that they should not be doing.
So bottom line, management do not retaliate against an employee for exercising their legal rights to be represented by a union. End of discussion there. Okay, Duncan, your final comment for this podcast.
Yeah, I just go back to our opening discussion on Oklahoma City. This is something that was seared into my brain. You know, it was my first, like I said, it was my first year as a federal employee. And it struck me very hard that you could be possibly put in harm's way. And, you know, when we've had the things like the World Trade Center, we've had the plane flying into the office in Texas, things of that nature. So it does happen. But NTEU make sure, along with management, because the vast majority of management is on board with us, to make sure that employees are as safe and secure as possible. And that's one thing that, you know, I want to make sure that people know is that we do care, we do watch this, we do work with management to try and make sure that every safeguard that we can be taken so that you're safe in your job.
I'm going to talk about Oklahoma City as well in my final comment, Duncan, because what I remember most about Oklahoma City is my opportunity to see the memorial. I drove out west and decided I was going to take that opportunity to stop for two nights in Oklahoma City because I wanted to spend the better part of a day at the memorial. You could walk around. The memorial itself is outside. They have a huge obelisk just a structure there. On one side of it, it's 901. The other side, it's 903. 901 was a minute before the bombing. 903 was, okay, 902 is when the bombing happened. The world changed as of 903. Beautiful reflecting pool. They also have chairs, one chair for all the 168 people who passed away. And for the children that died, they have smaller chairs. There were 19 children from that daycare who died in the bombing. What I remember most is showing my daughter that. She works with children in her job. And I was showing her pictures I had taken while I was there, and she was struck by the smaller chairs. And I said, those represent the children from the daycare. And she was just floored that so many children had died. When you see how many small chairs are in that memorial. To go to the, there is another part of it where you have to pay to get in, a museum, well worth your money. It's not that expensive. I would recommend doing that as well. But it's a time to remember Oklahoma City. We should never forget what happened there. And also remember what motivated these people to do this and work on that as well. You know, Timothy McVeigh was a very damaged man. He had been in the Gulf War. Everything that was shown in this documentary I referred to earlier, he had a serious case of PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, that which certainly was one factor in radicalizing him. He was not a well man. Plus, other things were happening that drew him to this. So people look at him as an evil man. I mean, I'm not justifying anything he did. But, you know, the fact is he had a story to tell, and they tried to explain how he came to where he was to the point where he would actually, you know, bomb a building of innocent people, including children, why he would do a thing like that. I think we need to understand that in order to move forward. Duncan, thank you very much, as always. This is the Chapter 49 podcast, and we thank you for taking some of your valuable time and spending it with us. We try to keep this weekly. We do most weeks. We miss a week now and then, but we try to make this as regular a podcast as possible. So in the meantime, we thank you again for listening and watching. Please be safe and be kind.